Gary Butterfield, he, him.
My name is Kaya Ross, she, her.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast.
And this week we are talking about Monster Train 2, which is a roguelike deck builder developed by Shiny Shoe and published by Devolver Digital for PC and consoles in 2025.
Yeah, this episode was executive produced by Joey. Big thanks to Joey.
Thank you, Joey. With
the caveat that I haven't played any other games that came out this year, this is my game of the year. I don't think that's quite true.
Well,
I know, yeah, but yeah. Yeah, for the most part, I haven't played a whole lot that came out this year, but Monster Train 2.
This is pretty hard to fuck with, even though it is, by and large, a lot more Monster Train, which is fine with me.
It's a lot more Monster Train. It's a lot better Monster Train.
Yeah.
It's more complicated Monster Train. And it's a spirit of Monster Train that just keeps giving. Mm-hmm. We're recording this on November 5th, which a whole bunch of content just dropped that hadn't made it to the Switch by the time we recorded, so I have not seen it. just a little, disclaimer, that's not going to be here in this episode. So if you're like, why didn't you talk about this boss? They're cool mechanics, and they sound cool. Mm-hmm. One of the new bosses, when it shows up, it summons all the units that still exist down to the bottom floor. Its units, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then gives a multi-strike, so like,
holy
you're
shit.
Really, really punished for not clearing out the riffraff.
Nice.
There's really cool mechanics coming up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to picking it back up because, like, you have definitely played so much more. Like, what Covenant level have you gotten to?
Oh, I have completed Covenant 10 with 23 of the combinations of 180. I play hundreds of hours. This has been my in the pocket game for since it came out.
Yeah. And I played somewhere between 20 and 30 hours enough to prep for the show. Not because I don't like this. In fact, Monster Train is like the kind of game like this that I super fucking enjoy. So I'm going to be leaning on you, Gary.
Oh, yeah. No, I've got at least prior to the update that happened today, I have good institutional knowledge of this. Mm-hmm. There are people who are way better than I am. There are people who have done Covenant 10 with all the clan combos. I have not done that. I'm just working through randoms, but I have, I can streak on Covenant 10 at about 5. I can get about 5 in a row.
Nice.
And then something happens and absolutely fucks me over. Mm-hmm. This is really similar to Monster Train 1. That's a game we covered in 2021, episode 305, similarly glowing. You can go back to that episode. It is a weird sequel that obviates the original.
Yes.
Which I think is a cool dispatch topic at some point.
Yeah. Spoilers here. You get a little bit of like a Pokemon Gold and Silver second act kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
It just builds on everything. Mm-hmm. Plays really similarly, but there are additional mechanics to add complexity. Mm-hmm. The basics are in that episode. We're going to go over that a little bit here, but that episode goes into it in more depth.
Yes. Go listen to it. And also, I don't know. I don't know about going and playing Monster Train right now when 2 is available. I am not your boss. If you take anything away, it's like, oh yeah, go play this. Do not look at the graphics. Do not get turned off by the vibe of it. It is just really fucking good.
Yeah. It's doing well. Mm-hmm. It's doing well, but I do want this developer to keep going.
Yeah.
So return your copy of Inkbound. And buy two copies of this.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Did you end up playing Inkbound?
It's installed on my computer now, but I have not played it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Just momentum and it not being on the Switch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Switch is my shiny shoe machine.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is Monster Train? So we have a little bit of context for when we talk about the new stuff.
Yes. So you're monsters in hell, and you're trying to escape all the rings of hell, carrying a pyre, a dwindling source of your power, on a train. It is a three-level train, and the gameplay, battles come where you deploy monsters on the three levels, and then invading monsters start at the bottom, work their way at the top to try to get to the pyre. This is kind of an abstract representation of something getting closer, to your base or what have you. The verticality will throw people off a little bit rather than going from right to left, going from down to up.
Yeah.
But you have three chances, basically. Mm-hmm. You have three different lines of defense you can set up.
Yes. And that's what you're doing. You're placing monsters for combat and you're playing spells which have direct effects. And you're kind of building a filter. Trying to build up some kind of filter or engine that will process incoming enemies into dead enemies before they can attack the pyre, which is kind of your health meter for the entire run.
Yes. Like all good deck builders, there is, engine building where you can kind of set something on autopilot. You will also discover synergies between these very complicated pieces that work together in ways you did not understand.
Yes.
They're all of the enemy waves, and then a boss wave comes in. The boss wave is do or die. It will not go to your pyre unless it kills you. So you get to fight it until it dies.
Yes. Combat plays out automatically at the end of a turn. It is not something where you go into Final Fantasy combat. Everybody does their thing. And something that is beautiful about Monster Train is you get a preview of how this is going to shake out. You will see, how much damage will be done, which of your units will die, which of their units will die. And that kind of clarity of information is super, super welcome from a planning perspective. Although I think that with Monster Train 2, some of the mechanics are so complicated that can't account for everything that happens during a battle now.
It's pretty close to it, but it's hard to see. Like they added to the preview being able to see debuffs on your units when the enemy does them. We're going to use a lot of keywords in this. I said this in the first Monster Train episode. This is the closest to a single-player Magic the Gathering game.
Yeah.
In a lot of weird ways, there are a lot of parallels to it. Like, obviously, the basic principles of a deck builder, like card advantage and having a small deck and everything, apply. But this kind of preponderance of keywords and then the new card types that they add in Monster Train 2 all have analogs to Magic.
Okay.
Feels a lot like Magic. So, like, it used to be let's say you cast a spell and your enemy has a thing, whenever you cast a spell on that floor, it debuffs your guys.
Mm-hmm.
It used to not preview that. In Monster Train 2, it does.
Yes.
Which is a godsend because you don't have to hover as much over everything.
Yeah. Going over and doing the little tooltip tour around everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Which we'll talk about.
So you're planning this out, you're playing it. I'm going to rely on you for those Magic the Gathering comparisons as it comes. Like, to me, this feels actually super similar to what is it, Darkest Dungeon 2, which Darkest Dungeon 2 came out after, but like I think about that and this in the same kind of bucket because of like all of the different kind of markers and tokens that go on to represent buffs and debuffs. Like, you get those keywords and we're just going to like refer to sap versus corruption. Similar things that operate very differently. Long. Well, yeah, no, but it's sorry.
I'm just kidding. Structurally, it has a lot to do with a Darkest Dungeon 2 or Slay the Spire.
Yes.
You know, in the actual play, you're defending, in Magic, you're defending yourself, deploying creatures to be a defense against your opponent.
Okay.
Here you're deploying creatures to defend the pyre.
Mm-hmm.
One of the secret sauces of this, and this is a secret sauce in Darkest Dungeon and Slay the Spire as well, is that between battles, you get to choose which of two tracks you take. And you get two bonuses on each one, you know, and you want them both.
Yeah.
You have to plan. That perfect information you have applies outside of battles as well. You can see the final boss
mm-hmm.
that you're going to face. And the if you're struggling in Monster Train, one of the things you're probably not doing is building for the final boss.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to plan ahead with that. But it's constantly making a choice where you want both things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. That's video games.
Yeah.
You know, it would be really, really great for me right now to get a holdover buff on the spell because that would change things. Mm-hmm. But one of my units needs trample or multi-strike or something because I can't punch through to the back line.
Yeah.
So I want to get that creature upgrade instead. And you have to choose.
Holdover being a modifier that you put on a spell I think it's just spells.
Yeah, just a spell.
Yeah, just spells where when you play it, it doesn't just go into the discard to be reshuffled when your, you know, deck runs out. It is just placed back on top of the draw pile. So you're always getting this bad boy.
Yep. You get to use it every turn.
Yeah.
It's really powerful. One of the Monster Train, another secret sauce of it is that it is not afraid to let you do really powerful shit.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing for me. This has huge Final Fantasy Tactics appeal insofar as, oh, I like this because it is a game that lets me break it over my knee.
Yeah, it's really fun. And then when mm-hmm. the game slowly ramps up to where kind of breaking it, the tactics you thought of as breaking it become necessary, you've learned how to break it more consistently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you unlock a new level of breaking where mm-hmm. you're like, oh, shit, like I didn't realize that, like, you know, the rage mechanic could get to the thousands,
you know,
but through weird stuff where you're just doubling every turn and everything, you uh-huh. get to wild shit like that. Rage being an offense buff.
Yes. it's like huge vibes of like Bellatro going into yes. scientific notation, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's very satisfying when you beat the final challenges of this game, which are appropriately hard.
Mm-hmm.
They're a test for how well you built your deck.
Yeah. Something that I am super happy about is I read an interview in doing prep for this. Very little like development detail on this, giving you a preview of that header when we get there. But you know, like the interviewer asked, like, have you ever thought about doing synchronous multiplayer? Where it's two players going off against each other. Like, yeah, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
and they didn't go any further into it. But like, can you imagine? Just like you would immediately take away the appeal of this game, Gary, if it was balanced for fairness and multiplayer.
You would almost have to do it as like a draft.
Yeah.
You know, or like a sealed deck in Magic terms. You couldn't have somebody build an engine and then bring it up against you because there would just mm-hmm. be dominant engines.
Yes.
It would have the same problem high level Magic does. But it's another one of the ways that this is one of the most Gary-coded games in the world is like no other people need apply. Monster Train is a solitary activity. You do yes. this with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no none of that shit, which I really love.
Yeah.
Monster Train 2 has kind of a different story. After the events of the first game and the DLC, the forces of hell escape into heaven, but their train is derailed by the Titans, these Eldritch beings that the Seraph, the boss of the first one, summoned to stop hell's arrival. So yeah. instead of going through hell, you're now going through heaven.
Yes, you're going into heaven and towards the abyss that is at the center of it. To ultimately go up against the Titans themselves, though you're not going to be doing that for a very long time.
Yeah, that's the end game thing. There are multiple points in which you can say you've beat this. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them is just beating Seraph at the end, but having beaten the Titans is kind of the next thing.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's all sicko shit, like winning with all the clan combinations and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So character wise, like each of the clans that you have has a champion. Like one of the first ones you get, Fel, who was an angelic boss from the first game, gathers up these forces to take on Seraph and the Titans. And this is the last that we're going to speak about the story. We were talking about it on Slack, and it's like, this is the game that I love the most that I have the meanest things to say about.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. Like somebody else on the team, and I don't want to, like, let's say on the off chance, somebody from the team listens to this. I don't right. want to hurt anyone's feelings.
No.
And I've talked to people in the wild who do like the story
okay.
of this. I can't get it. Mm-hmm. The story itself feels very generic. to me. And one of the things that happens that you didn't get to, but I wanted you to get to in a, like, here, this stinks, smell it, kind of sense, is that after you complete the storyline, they do little, you unlock in the base in between missions, little skits.
Yes.
That the characters will do. I think some of those happen before, but they're more frequent after you beat it.
Yeah, you get those like after you unlock Pyre Hearts mostly.
Okay.
And you start getting new clans. This is kind of those two things, which are broadly your progress to the game anyway. At least at the start. But like anytime you cross some kind of threshold, you get a little skit with the different champions from the different factions.
And good God.
Yeah.
Are these dire? Mm-hmm. Like, if you want to know the kind of joke that is in the skit, I was thinking about like the kind of joke. And here's the kind of joke. This guy who's a dragon says, "Oh, somebody ate my chocolate cake." And then it switches to one of the champions. He goes, "Not me." And then it switches to another champion. And he goes, "Not me." And the third champion has cake crumbs on his mouth. And goes, "Brr, brr," with his mouth full. And that's the fucking joke. It is the limpest dick webcomic that you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Like, I don't know how they did it.
Yeah, you know, and that kind of extends. I don't care for the visual style on these guys very much. The thing I can say about them is they are readily distinguishable, but like if this was just Bellatro and each of these was just a little hand-drawn icon, that would suffice for me here. This goes to wireframe very quickly to me.
The visuals to me remind me of like World of Warcraft kind of stuff, or like, and I think in the second one, there are a couple of things I like a little bit more. There are a couple of bosses that look kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like the way the mushroom folk look.
Oh, the mushroom folk are great. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of things that are a little bit better, but visually it's designed for clarity, you know, as opposed to appeal to me aesthetically.
Yes.
You know, which is fine. Like it is entirely a numbers and words game. For me.
Yes. Yeah.
Music is good.
Mm-hmm.
Like I like the music in this. I think the songs get you pumped.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of earworms in there. Generally think the music is pretty good.
Yeah. And like different bosses have different have their own themes and stuff. Like you end up like building a lot of familiarity with these through repetition, and it stands up to that. Although I will say this is also kind of a little bit of a podcast game for me.
Yes. Yeah. It works just fine for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to the new themes they introduced with the new bosses.
Mm-hmm.
Today.
Literally right now. We could be playing it right now, but we're not, because this episode needs to get out.
So aesthetically, no great shakes, and it might, that your mileage may vary, the takeaway is if you look at this and you're like, this looks like, you know, Clash of Clans dog shit, it's not. Just, you know, that's the aesthetic it has.
Like I said,
as was foretold
in the scrolls, not a lot of development details on this. I think I saw two interviews that somebody did, like the CEO of the company. And, you know, I will go back into the archive of like the Steam like news posts, because oftentimes there will be fun little dev, you know, diary kind of things, updates here. All of those are just new feature announcements.
Yeah.
In one of the interviews that I read on Gaming Bolt, the CEO said, "Yeah, our goal was to improve on every element of the original." To which I say, "Great."
My goal when I'm racing is to go the fastest.
Yes.
You know, my goal is to do the good job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, I think they succeeded in that.
Yeah.
Would be the takeaway. I do think this is a better game than the first one. Even though it's really interesting, if one had not played the first one, this has a harsher onboarding.
Yes.
I think. This kind of picks up where the last one left off in terms of complexity.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Additionally, the original clans, like their hooks were easier to discern.
Yes.
Like starting you with the Banished as your default clan is fucking wild to me.
The Banished is like, this was something that Will Hughes of the AV Club, close friend, talked about in his review of it, is that it does start out pretty complicated. Yeah. But I think if you think of it you're not comparing the Banished to the first clan of the first game. Mm-hmm. You're comparing them to like the fourth or fifth clan of the first game, like the Melting Remnant and the shadowy boys, mm-hmm. the Penumbra guys. Those guys are pretty complicated.
Yeah.
Like Morsel mechanics, Reform mechanics are complicated. Banish is about on par with that.
Yeah.
And then it scales up. And they kind of had to do that because they have to mm-hmm. explore new game spaces.
Yeah.
You know, with mm-hmm. that. But it is complicated. It takes a little while. The game will teach you how to play it, but you have to pay attention and you have to internalize a lot of shit.
Yes. And the tooltip game is on point with this.
Yeah.
I play this on the Switch as well, and you just highlight a unit and then hold a shoulder button and it just pops up like definitions of everything, including definitions within definitions.
Yes.
Yeah.
It sounds super overwhelming. It does have a tutorial. It will teach you how to play it.
Yes.
You know, it is a complicated game. It's not mm-hmm. like Crusader Kings complicated though.
Right. Yeah. So this was announced in February of this year of 2025 and a free demo came out. Did you play that demo?
I didn't. I don't like doing demos because I want to play the full thing.
Same.
My understanding is the demo was just the first two clans. So it was basically the game,
mm-hmm.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
Like that's how you play the game when you first play until you unlock stuff for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And then you get you got the full version out in May, and I waited for that. No interest in a demo that doesn't carry over progress at the very least.
Not my thing. Mm-hmm. They keep supporting the game, as we mentioned. A major update a few months ago that was really big. Mm-hmm. Mostly adding just new cards, but they're important, cool cards.
Yeah,
and rebalancing, and then a big update today. Mm-hmm. Major patch. They're also doing a DLC in Q1 next year. I hate saying Q for a thing, but that is what it is.
It is within the first 3 months or so. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really hoping for, it's a confirmed new clan. Nice. And I think a confirmed new gameplay mode, which I think is really interesting.
Huh.
The one thing, like when we talk about this obviating the first one, the DLC for the first one is really cool.
Okay.
Did you ever get around to that?
No, I didn't. I didn't get to play with the Wormkin at all.
The Wormkin are really neat, and the shard system they introduce is really neat.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they introduce something similar for this, if not the same thing.
Give me an overview of the Wormkin and the shard system. Like what's the Wormkin's like hook, and then how does shard differ from stuff that was introduced here?
The Wormkin adds a little kind of marker on each of the floors where you can put a little crystal. Like you mm-hmm. have certain cards will add a crystal to that.
Okay.
And then there are dependent things on that. Sometimes a creature will grow depending on that. But the most frequent thing is it does a different kind of damage to the opponent mm-hmm. if they have a status. So they'll get I can't remember the name of it right now, but they get a status to take 3 damage per crystal. As a thing, instead of it being like frostbite, they take it at the end of combat.
It's
a hefty chunk of damage.
Okay.
The other hook they have is playing with consume cards, mm-hmm. having which they brought back for the mushroom people.
Yes, yeah.
But consume cards, you can only use them once per battle. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of synergies with that. So they have a mechanic called etch, which is when you use a consume card, something happens.
Okay.
And then the shards allow you either to like superpower a card or combine two creatures. Like each creature has an element you can add, like graft onto another creature.
Oh shit.
At the cost of making the rest of the game more difficult.
Okay.
So you have shard levels and like that, this will, you know, at shard level 15, enemies get this much more health.
Okay. You know,
stuff like that. This enemy gets this keyword at shard level 50. Mm-hmm. You have to be really careful, but it allowed you to make like truly insane units.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that were brought over from units were interesting,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you could get a trample on units, which is not something you can buy in the store. Like you can add that to something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's real neat. It adds a whole different concern, you know, mm-hmm. your power versus its challenge. And like, are you making a choice good enough to meet the challenge it's going to add?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Really cool.
Yeah, that sounds rad.
Yeah. And the final boss as well, which you get to by getting 100 shards.
And that comes back in this, right?
Yes.
Like this one of the Titans. A version of it. It looks very similar. Prism guy.
It's, yeah. Yeah.
the manifestation of the internet from the end of Fahrenheit or from the end of Indigo Prophecy.
It also has sex with a dead person.
Yes.
But that's one of those skits. So I
technically
skipped
it. Dead. Yeah. It was very grim. Was like,
Mademoiselle Lion's Mane had sex with a dead person, but as I don't know, there's a bunch of like 2003 humor in it. So I skipped it.
They were all on a couch.
Yep.
Yeah. The trample keyword, trample is super powerful because if what that does is if you kill and if you overkill an enemy at the front with an attack on a unit that has trample, the damage spills back to the unit behind the one in the front.
And it can continue. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, typically the enemies have a tank unit up front and then weaker enemies behind. So with a high enough, you know, hard hitting trampler, you can take out the wave.
Yeah, yeah. And this is distinct from sweep, which attacks everybody, but generally can be weaker, but you can power it up if you want to, because everything could be powered up because this is Monster Train, baby.
Yeah. Because if you, all the parts work together, like this is a big toy box of different keywords and parts that you craft a way to combine.
Yeah.
In ways you think are neat and would be cool.
Yeah.
And you try stuff and then you get surprised by it. There are a bunch of kind of new basic features of this before we talk about the clans here. One of them is at the beginning of every run, you select what your pyre heart is. This is the power source at the top of your train. You unlock these by meeting different kind of conditions. And these are things you'll usually do naturally through play.
Yeah. No.
You know, playing a certain number of cards of a certain type, upgrading, winning a little challenge mode, spending a certain amount of money. You know, things like that. And these are kind of like a feat, almost, or like a quirk in Fallout terms for the rest of your run.
Yes. And these can be pretty broken. The one you start with doesn't have anything except for just generally hardy stats on its own. Every one of the Pyre Hearts has its health rating, but also has an attack. Like it can defend itself. But there are enemy builds that get around that. Quite a bit.
So these will give you different advantages, and you can kind of use these to shore up weaknesses that you have in your clan, or just to ignore a part of the game you don't like. You know, one of the things I can do this, I don't dislike it, but one of the ones that I think is a good thing to unlock early for people is the Bogworm's growth. Weak attack, weak health, but every battle it adds a little bit of extra space to a random floor.
That's so wild.
It's super good. You don't have to take that upgrade. You know, at the end of a boss, every third, the third and sixth boss, you get a major upgrade. And you can choose either to get more mana, more space on every floor, or more card draw. And this kind of takes care of one of those at the expense of having a weak pyre heart.
Yes. But with that much space, you have much more ability to allocate units to defend it. So you have a better chance on that. I ended up rolling quite a bit with. I kind of went between. What is the one that lets you heal the front unit on every floor once per battle?
Wings
Spirit. Yeah.
Wings.
Yeah,
that one's H's and Y's in that.
That one's super easy to get because all you have to do is shift, a little bit, and you start with the shifting clan. Shifting is like moving units around.
Which is the keyword for moving.
Yes, but just like once per battle, being able to like top off your tanks is especially good when you remember to use it.
And a lot of these will just be like a once per battle thing you can deploy. These can change things kind of crazy. You know, there's one that allows you to copy cards like everywhere instead of a special events. That's real cool if you're going to do a real card. There's one that makes everything appear with a random upgrade. That one's neat. It's kind of a crapshoot because if you get a creature that you would like to put a good upgrade on and it has a bad upgrade on, that sucks. But a lot of times it's just bonus and upgrades are really expensive.
Yeah.
Saves you a lot of money.
Yeah. And just, it's just a random, it's just every time you get one of these things, ended up rolling with that. That one is also, man, we'll talk about the dimensional challenges. That first dimensional challenge you have to do to get this thing is really weird, but also enlightening.
Remind me what it is. I haven't done it since the game came out.
It's the one that, is, like, completely equipment focused. So I forget all of the commands on it, but like, you get all kinds of bonuses for equipping things. And also, like you can't unequip or something. Forgive me because I don't remember it. The main problem with it is, the reliance. It just fills you with, the little sacrifice whelps. Your deck is full of those damn things. And at first it seems like, okay, what is this 1-1 unit useful for? And then you realize, oh, I can intentionally trigger like siphon effects. Anything that will activate when something dies, I can control when and where that happens by using these things, by sacrificing them.
Siphon being the enemy version, like something happens when one of your characters die, and then harvest is the player version, which is whenever anything dies.
Yes.
A certain thing happens, usually a stat up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bunch of these that are really cool. Once you beat the actual final boss, the first three times you beat the Titans, you unlock kind of the super pyres at the end. I'm going to spoil what those are mechanically. Mechanical spoilers will happen in this episode because they're all really cool.
Yeah.
The first one, all your friendly units get +1 power on slay, like permanently.
So ridiculous.
Super good. Like if you get one of those sweeping units, it's going to take out a lot of guys.
Yeah.
They're going to get really powerful. My favorite is called the Pyre of Dominion, and it removes the train stewards. We'll talk about what those are. And the starting cards and lets you draft. You get to pick cards for your run.
Wow.
For that. So they give you three cards, three creatures of each clan, three spells of each clan. And you get to choose those to have your thing. Your deck will start slimmer. You won't have to get rid of the jobber cards.
Yeah.
That you start with.
We can just say what train stewards are. These are clanless units that pretty much you always have at the beginning. Generally the shield steward and the spear steward, do very little damage, generally don't have an awful lot of health. They are there just so you have something. Usually when you are proceeding through a run, you replace them.
Yeah. One of them's a tank. One of them's an attack one. That's one of the things they changed with Monster Train 2. They used to just be the same thing. And now there's an attack and defense one. It's necessary when you first start before you have any creatures. Like you only have your champion. You need to use these. This gives you other creatures instead. And one of the things, again, if you're struggling with Monster Train, get rid of your train stewards.
Yeah.
You have to trim your deck.
Keep it so you only draw the good stuff and not one of these jobbers. Of course, you can build towards making your train stewards ridiculously powerful. There's a room card that that makes them into ridiculous powerhouses.
And you can upgrade them like any other unit as well. So they can just kind of be a blank unit with no abilities.
Yeah. But upgrade units, they do not apply to multiple copies is the thing.
Yes.
So like if you want to make one endless or whatever, it's only that particular one.
Yeah. So you have to draw that one.
Yeah.
Through that. The final one you unlock, I haven't fucked with that much, but it's interesting. You get a blight card, the blight card that does a damage if you don't spend it. And we'll talk about blights in a moment. You get one of those after each battle. But you draw one extra card for every two blights in your deck, and it has a lot of health, so it can tank those blights. So this is kind of the same way the Bogworm one gets rid of space concerns. This one gets rid of draw concerns.
Nice.
For you. Apparently pretty good. I haven't fucked with it very much, though, because I'm addicted to the drafting.
Yeah. It's pretty good. It's nice having that early control.
It's real fun. Like, it is a really cool... it's why I'm able to do real well at Covenant 10. You know, because otherwise it'd be very difficult.
Yeah.
It's also interesting too, because some clans need their kind of starter cards or work best with their starter cards. You know, we talked about the Banished, their primary mechanic. One of them is shifting, moving your cards or moving your units. One of their basic cards moves a unit.
Yeah.
If you are playing with the Banished and you're using the Pyre of Dominion where you get different cards, you don't start with something that moves units automatically. Which means you have to build around that. It's still a really powerful clan, But you have to build it in a different way.
Yeah. Build it to take advantage of Valor, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Valor, or you can also just ignore clans, which is awesome.
Yeah.
This is true in the first one too, but if you get something powerful enough, I'm going to sprinkle tips because this is the most bullshit game that we ever do.
Yeah, no, that's what I wanted when I structured the notes this way.
I want people to play this game. Don't become so dependent on your champion. Mm-hmm. You can have runs where you have a unit that is better than your champion, and your champion can just not do that much. Mm-hmm. And don't feel like you have to stay balanced between the two clans. If you get a synergy for one clan that's working really, really well, you can really minimize the other clan.
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel tied to what starts out. You just need to make a powerful deck.
Yes.
Through this. So like ignoring your champion sometimes was a hard lesson for me to learn because that's the main character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm that guy.
That's the guy. The leader.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there are ones that are just a unit and you can treat them as such.
Also, you don't always have to play your champion on the first floor. That is a complacency thing that I had to break myself out of. Fortunately, when you get to the later clans, it's almost mandated that you do that.
It depends on the thing you're fighting.
Yeah.
With this, it's really interesting. In the first one, it was almost universally better to set up on the top floor. Mm-hmm. Like it gave you more time to prep for things and buff things up. One of the things Monster Train 2 did subtly through its enemy and boss design was discourage that. There are several bosses where you will be punished by playing on the top floor because they just get more powerful as they go up.
Yeah.
Specifically the Ring 6, the Rusty.
Yeah.
The Lord of Cherubs, who looks like the Id.
Yeah.
from that episode of Venture Brothers.
Hate that guy.
Yeah, he eats cherubs. He eats California cheeseburgers all day long. but all of his guys get more powerful as they move up. So you have to be able to set up on the bottom floor by him.
Yeah.
You know, generally. I always set up on the top floor. The other thing it kind of does is it encourages in Monster Train 1, the strategy was to make one super floor through things. You can still do that, but there are things that encourage you to do multi-floor setups.
Yeah.
In this more than previously, which I like.
Yeah. Something I love is the addition of the deployment phase. I didn't realize this was new at first. Mm-hmm. I was like, this just makes perfect sense. It wasn't until I did some more reading. I was like, dealing with enemies coming in at the same time I was using my card draws to just get people on the floor.
Yeah. And you're at the luck of the draw. The way Monster Train 1 did it was there were units called banner units that you were guaranteed to draw in your opening hand. Now there are still units that are count as that, but they show up in a phase where you have a certain, you have your normal amount of Ember plus one. Ember is mana. All these cards have a cost to put guys out in advance. Mm-hmm. Your champion doesn't cost anything.
Yes.
So you always can kind of set up in advance. This synergizes with that floor bit before. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to set up on the top floor for this enemy. I need to set up on the bottom floor for this enemy.
Yes.
Through this.
And you can make your deployment phase more powerful. There are a good number of artifacts that are built around that, giving you more mana in order to deploy there, or bringing in cards that are not starters for that.
Yeah. One of the things they added today as we speak is an upgrade that allows you to turn any unit into a deployable unit.
God damn.
Typically, the units that are not deployable are like common units that have niche uses.
Yeah.
You know, and now you can get those out. So, for example, with the Banished, they have little angel guys who play instruments.
Little herald, kind of hymnist, yeah, I think. Yeah.
Hymnist. Those do a buff for the whole floor. They're not deployable, though, because that would be very powerful. You can now set them up to be deployable if you get that event or upgrade. Mm-hmm. I haven't played with it because it's happening now.
I feel like I have bugs on my skin.
Yeah. I haven't played with it the same way I'm not outside playing right now. You know, it's that feeling. Like, I don't know what's out in front of it. I'm looking at a computer. I'm not looking at my street.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of the deployment phase. Really strong, really smart.
Mm-hmm.
There are two new card types. We talked about equipment and rooms previously. These are things that are very much like Magic: The Gathering analogs to rooms are kind of like enchantments. equipment is kind of like equipment.
Okay.
The way these work is a room will do something to the whole floor. These are always beneficial to you. There's one that does damage to everything on the floor, which is really great.
Yeah.
You can just avoid that floor. It's like, we don't go there. Mm-hmm. it does 50 damage every turn. I don't go there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the Inferno one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It takes a little while to figure out how to use that one, but it is good. Mm-hmm. And then equipment are things that, you know, they have the same cost as a creature, but you add them to a creature. Yeah. So they supplement it. It's basically, it's not that different from a spell that would give, the monster those abilities, mm-hmm. but it interfaces with deployment and other benefits. Like you can get a artifact that lets you draw one when you deploy and it costs mm-hmm. nothing.
Yeah.
You know, so you can start with a guide, with a piece of equipment.
Yeah. And there's a whole clan that is, built around the equipment system, the Lazarus League, or that's one of their things.
It's kind of the Banished, their other kind of thing, other than Valor, is they have a lot of equipment synergies as well.
Yeah.
They want to onboard you with that.
Mm-hmm.
And these very powerful and again, synergistic.
Yes.
Each clan has, there's generic rooms and equipment, and then each clan has specific flavorful rooms and equipment that synergize with what they do.
Yes. Yeah.
A lot of ways, the journey of playing Monster Train is figuring out what the clan's deal is.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, like you play for a while until you realize like, oh, this is what these people are good at. And mm-hmm. to me, the joy of a game like this is reading their abilities and trying to like intuit what that would be and then testing it.
Yeah, because there are some that just don't make any sense as you play it. Like one of the things when we get to the Lazarus League to talk about that is like everything is constantly self-destructing.
Yeah, there's a self-destruction like self-mechanic similar to the Melting Remnant in the first one. That's really powerful. Like mm-hmm. all of these things, one of the other things that I love about Monster Train is there are like, tier lists or whatever. There are clans mm-hmm. that are more powerful. Everything's viable.
Yeah, everything is fun to play. Yeah.
Fun and can be powerful. Mm-hmm. Like the exploding Lazarus League things, like there's a way to make that work and it can mm-hmm. be insane. You just have to figure it out. It's a puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's the satisfying thing because yes. getting familiar also opens up the ability to find those synergies and just, break them apart. And like the clan rooms are more like that. The clanless rooms have some very like, don't disregard those. Like, no. The silence chamber.
Like, yeah, that's really, really good.
You put that on the first floor. So like silence, gets rid of all of your enemies, like buffs and debuffs, basically any of their magical shit. And so like you get things coming in, especially later on that have melee resistance, damage resistance. There are there's a spell resistance one. All of that goes away.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Or they have, we talked about earlier, triggers. When you do something, they do something to you.
So yes.
Every time I cast a spell on this floor, this asshole in the back of the enemy's line buffs their entire team.
Mm-hmm.
It turns that shit off.
So enemies attack, like they're part of like little squadrons that are all kind of organized around a theme. You can just get rid of that for one floor if you want to.
It basically also neutralizes bosses. Because mm-hmm. bosses, they hit, they're a monster, but most of their threat comes from their special ability.
Yeah.
After that. I'm real fond of the boiler room, which every time a unit dies on the floor, you get one mana.
It's so overpowered.
Super good. Like it takes care of, the mana for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, it synergizes really well with decks that use spells. You can cast spells directly on enemies, kill them, and you get the mana back.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows you to keep doing stuff.
Yeah.
That one's real good.
Yeah.
Equipment, there's a little bit less to talk about in individual bits. There are some equipments that are really weird.
Mm-hmm.
I love the one that turns you into an ever-growing super ape.
I love that one so much.
Did you get the one where you just get bigger every turn uh-huh. and more powerful?
Yeah, you turn into a goldfish. And you get big until you can't anymore.
Yeah. I don't know if you found this. If you take that, if you add that to the upgrade on your character that keeps them at one size,
uh-huh.
that upgrade overrides it. So they'll keep growing in power, but not in size.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It's super cool. Like if there's a cool answer to how two things would interact, the game chooses it.
Yes.
So that's really powerful. There's also a thing that they just introduced where you can have a character in stasis. More powerful until you unleash them. So if you can let them wait for a little while, they get buffs every turn, and then when you unleash them, they're much more powerful.
That thing, that specific piece of equipment was so clutch for me. You know, as I started, it was a run winner. If I got that,
it's real good.
And there are ones that are like a little bit more like meat and potatoes, like the equalizing rings. Like I would always take those. That can turn so that makes your attack the same as your health. And if you're deploying like a tank unit, tank will have low attack, very high health. You can suddenly turn that into a really good damage dealer like that.
Yep. And if you're thinking like, does that synergize with things that increase your health every turn? Like, of course it does.
Yeah, of course. They always take the coolest option. Yeah.
Yeah. The game is never going to say no. So like if you put that, there's a floor where your characters will gain health every time they heal. Mm-hmm. And you can put that equipment on there. You can also combine two pieces of equipment together. So like you can put that on the, you can put all three of those things to have a character that is ever growing really powerfully.
Yeah.
You just have to find the cards for it. You have to find the combo.
Mm-hmm. And there's equipment that you can put on enemies too. Like the blood suit and the death suit.
There's only two right now. Yeah. I think this is something they're going to expand either today or in the next update, because it feels a little bit like an underutilized mechanic.
Yeah, but just like if you have an enemy who moves around a lot, like say the three main bosses, all of whom flit from floor to floor, you just slap that bad boy on there and they either take damage every time they do that, or the death suit gives them melee weakness.
Yeah, they take double damage to the next attack.
Yeah.
They take really strong. Mm-hmm. And that stacks. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
Equipment's really fun. Really, really smart addition. Mm-hmm. Blights and Scourges are back. These are cards that you don't want. These are bad cards that usually they have a consequence if you don't play them. So they're just there to cost mana. And usually, especially on early covenants, you take them as a consequence for something.
Yes.
You go to an event, it gives you a really powerful ability, but you're going to get this bummer card in your hand. Mm-hmm. And if you draw it, you have to play it or something bad happens.
Yes. Oftentimes it is damage to your pyre. And you have to start because these things cost mana to get out, get out of the way. So this is reducing your capacity to do stuff. Sometimes you might just decide, well, pyre is going to take 3 damage here. Like I'm toward the end of the run. It's going to be fine.
Yeah, it's fine. You know, another kind of Magic the Gathering and deck builder thing, like your health is a resource.
Yes.
You spend it. You don't preserve it. You know, it's not you.
Yeah.
As long as you still win if you have 1 health left. Mm-hmm. At the end, these ramp up as you go Iron Covenants. On the 10th Covenant, you start with 2 of the low level ones in your deck. Mm-hmm. And then when you draft at the end of a battle, when you choose from 3 cards, one of them will always come with a big card that does nothing. You just have to spend 3 to get rid of it forever. But it does nothing. It's just a dead draw until you can spare 3 mana.
Okay. Yeah.
Purge.
Their enemies and enemy kind of assortments that play into the blights and stuff too. I'm thinking specifically of those fucking bell people.
Yeah. they'll give them to you, and that's one of the ways that the game is encouraging you to play on all floors.
Yeah,
as opposed to the top floor. Like guy will, if you set up a super floor on the top, these guys will hit you on the bottom 2 floors, and every time they do that, add a blight to your next draw. Mm-hmm. So eventually, you get to the point where you're only drawing blights, and they're harder to defend against once they get up to the top.
Yeah.
Monsters can have abilities now. You click on them and they do a thing. These have cooldowns. This also has a magic analog to like an activated ability.
Yeah.
I think that you have in the notes that you wish you were better about using these. This took me a minute too.
Yeah.
I think the devs knew this. They give you a little lightning bolt symbol that tells you one of your abilities is ready.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a long time to internalize who has what ability.
Right.
I would see like, oh, I have an ability ready, but I don't know what it is early on. And now I've got to memorize basically. But up until that point, it was difficult to remember to use these.
Yes. And this can be a very big deal.
There are some new things about the map. There are trials in this. I think, I can't remember if this was in the first one. I think it is in the first one base game. Where you can take a problem, like a debuff, beginning the battle, and get more money for it. And these can range from getting less draw, getting less ember, having enemies start on every floor.
To like ridiculous ones where like, enemies have Titanite now, which is just straight up damage resistance.
Damage resistance, the Penitent Prayer Stone, like the wall that enemies have that has spikes on it that hurts you to attack. That's a real problem. And these are, you know, you just decide whether these are worth it at the time. The entire game is deciding, am I powerful enough to do this thing to get more power?
One that seems like it's going to be a fucking nightmare, but is actually just, I've had really good success just taking it every time it popped up was, I forget what the name of it is, but it is the enemies will appear on all floors at the start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Mark of Invasion, I think that's called.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That one's really easy to deal with if you have the ability, like you'll take some pyre damage on the first round usually, but you set up on the top floor.
Yeah.
Then you usually have no problem. And the rewards you get for these are significant. You need money.
Yes.
Again, you know, just this game being Gary Butterfield Nip, the economy is something that, you know, the same way you want every choice between two paths, you want money.
Yeah.
In this, like, I would like money because I want to do these cool things. It never feels superfluous. I'm never getting a benefit that doesn't feel like anything.
Yeah.
You know,
that's one of the ways.
I was just going to say, like, contrast that with games that are not like this, you know, and even games I love, right? Like, it just doesn't, you get to the point where I'm like, it reminds me of like Resident Evil 4. Like, Resident Evil 4, I am, you know, avarice. Like, I want money.
Yes.
You know, in that game. And that is what you do. You play the game to get the money. Like, making me want to do something more than just advance in the game, I think, is really powerful.
Yeah.
As a game design tool.
And it becomes a resource you can use later. Like, there's a whole clan built around, built around money, and making it, and then also using it as a resource in battle, which is very fun. Yeah.
Money is how you buy all the things we've been talking about. So like,
yes,
you buy equipment, you buy rooms, you buy, you know, upgrades to your spells and your units.
Yeah. You, something that, kind of pops up when you are on the map between battles, and a way that you, can end up building some momentum, two things that are always mutually exclusive, unless this changes on higher updates or on higher covenants, is like one path will have something that will heal the damage on your pyre heart. The other will just have, here's some cash.
There's cash. Those will be random. They're not always a choice between those two.
I never ran into a place where one was on the same side of the other. So that's why I'm generalizing probably.
It kind of, you usually get on either side, each one has an upgrade thing, either rooms, magic, you know, or spells or units, and then two other miscellaneous things. And these can be like a pile of cash, getting a free room or artifact. Getting duplicating one of your cards, getting rid of two of your cards, healing your pyre, things like that. And then there's these things called celestial alcoves, which are random events.
Community chest
And these are great. Like, you sometimes will get something that kind of sucks in here, but generally these are really powerful.
And even the ones that kind of suck, you get the impression that it is, I just don't understand how that would be a benefit yet.
Or it's not good for my run.
Yes.
You know, a bunch of these are Easter eggs with other games, and they're really cute.
It's extremely cute. I got to the inscription one, and I was like, aw.
did you solve the puzzle with the inscription one?
No, I didn't. What is that?
The inscription one, it's the stoat from Inscription, and it says, you know, you get to choose between three upgrades, and they're kind of weird. One of them gives your character the ability to reanimate. We'll talk about that when we talk about that clan. One of them makes the character, when you can sacrifice them for mana. And a third one, I can't remember at this point, but on whatever one you get, if you actually go into your card list, which you never do, and look at that unit, it will have little directions, like a combination of right and left. And if for the next couple of times you do that, go the directions it says, the stoat reappears and gives the unit all three of the things.
Oh my God.
And one of them is when you summon it, you can summon another one for one more mana, if since it has the sacrifice on it. It's like a, basically a big mana thing. You can turn a unit into like a pay pig for mana, paying into the sacrifice themes of Inscription.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful how they take the it's not just, hey, do you recognize this iconography? It is, how do we work in the mechanics of this?
Yeah, like the feel of it.
Yeah. You know? The Belatra one is really great. Like, they even do the thing where you get the Gros Michel and it'll turn into the Cavendish.
Yep. It breaks. That one's always available. The other ones are the different super jokers.
Yeah.
And that the unique jokers in that. And they're really interesting. Mm-hmm. They vaguely kind of play a little bit like the ones in Balatro, like Chakot, which is the one that disables boss blinds in Balatro, makes bosses start with three turns of not being able to, of being muted, of being silenced. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But these are really cool as well. And it's cute to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like it.
And there's at least one that has a guest designer.
There's one.
Yeah.
With Richard the Garfield. Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is really cool.
Yeah. The wondrous boxes. Designer.
Yeah. The boxes, which allow you to combine cards, like put them in a box. So when you draw the box, you get all three things. Or you can get a random card each turn.
Yeah.
All of which are real powerful. Some of these are references to the last game.
Yeah.
Like the story. There's one for Inkbound as well. It's pretty neat. These are fun.
Yeah. Generally like those. And you can always opt out of them too. You can just say, I don't feel like messing with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes you'll get money for that. Sometimes not.
I never pressed my luck on the mirror, on the enchanted mirror, where it's like, okay, you can throw one card in there and get it duplicated, or you can try and be greedy and try and do it five times. I never did it five times.
It's not greedy. It's you can just do it five times, but you now have five more copies of that card in your deck.
Yeah.
So it's like a deck building concern. Mm-hmm. You're going to draw a lot of that card. That's really powerful if you do it with something with consume.
Yeah.
Because then it's not going to clog up your deck after you use it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that can be, and just getting one copy is good. Usually what I do, you have to have kind of the right setup to make the five copies work.
Yeah. Same thing with just the map node that lets you duplicate a card. You can make a super unit that is more powerful than your champion. And I sometimes do those because like there's no downside to having one of those bad boys on another floor.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually it's real cool. Yeah. It works super well. There's some new modes in it. There is an endless mode that I have not fucked with.
I did a little bit. So this is after you successfully complete a run. So when you beat Seraph, for me, because I never got to the Titans, when you beat Seraph, it'll say like, it'll give you your round end score and it'll say, do you just want to keep going? And instead of proceeding along like another map or whatever, where you're getting, choices between two paths with their own little things, you never go back to the map again. It is just a series of battles with a choice of a boon in between.
Okay. And that makes sense.
Like, and the way that it makes it harder, like obviously the numbers are going to go up, but also like boons start coming with drawbacks as well.
Right on.
Yeah.
It's, I am trying to get all the clan combos in the background. I'm probably not going to get all 180 because that's insane, but I'm more interested in seeing the new things than seeing how far I can get.
Yeah.
In this right now. The other thing, there's, this isn't the first one as well. There are dimensional challenges. These were things you just turned on as opposed to being a little, how do you describe it? Like a little tech tree.
Yeah.
Like it is now. These are puzzle runs. They give you specific decks. They give you specific conditions that break the rules of the game generally. It's the same kind of modifiers. Like think of mutations in Left 4 Dead. It gives you a stack of those that are around a theme.
Yeah.
For this. So like your enemies, every one of your enemies has spike, or every one of your characters has spikes, but they start with sap. So they can't attack. They just have spikes. They'll hurt the enemy that fights them. Things like that. There's a wide variety of these.
Yeah. So the one that I was talking about before, like the one you're going to do to unlock that really good pyre heart, weapons make the warrior, just to actually give an example of this, you're playing, banished / pyreborn, like you do at the beginning. Because it is built around weapons, using weapons, or equipment, does not cost any mana. Like they're mm-hmm. always free. And you get 3 random equipment cards at the start, added nice. Into your deck. All the benefits from those, from equipment are doubled, but the downside to it is that, the modifier is called No Fluff. All of your cards will have one fewer upgrade slot.
Gotcha. Yeah. They want you to use the equipment. And see how powerful that is. Like mm-hmm. all things like, you know, Monster Train, some of these, the same way Growing in Covenants can sometimes make you more powerful in addition yeah. to being more challenging, some of the challenges are easier, you know, yeah. or at least like a side grade mm-hmm. to teach you something.
Yeah.
As opposed to just being a challenge mode.
And that's what I like about Monster Train. And like there are other games like this that kind of internalize an achievement. Kind of structure, in order to teach you stuff, about the game,
like famously yes, does it, that, you know,
yeah.
There are some about half the challenges in Isaac are interesting, not necessarily challenges.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, this would work, you know, this is kind of cool, or it's a cute theme.
Yeah.
The biggest change in this, in addition to all the things we talked about, new bosses and stuff, are new clans. There are 5 new clans. Each one has 2 champions. They play differently. You unlock the first champion, and then as you play, you unlock the second one.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the different clans here and kind of their vibe, mm-hmm. their general thing they do.
Yes. You're not just unlocking champions, like you are leveling them up with, you're leveling up the clan itself. Yeah. And you are unlocking cards as you go. I don't know that I'd love this decision in this game to not let you have the things that are going to define the clan in the first kind of handful as you go. This is one of the things that I do not feel like these are meted out in such a way that I felt like I was being kind of onboarded into what this clan is about.
I think that's probably the intention.
Yeah.
You know, is that they, you know, with, so like using an example, like using the Banished clan, they want you to think about Valor and Shift.
Like yeah.
Those are the 2 things, the champion, the first champion fell has as keywords and kind of synergies, and the opening cards do. Mm-hmm. And they want you to get used to that. And then as you get more cards, it adds a couple more dimensions.
Yeah.
I would want there to be just an option in the menu that unlocks everything.
Yeah.
There might actually be, I haven't looked mm-hmm. but like that would be my preference for this. Like you can skip that grind if you want to and just play with the full toy.
Yeah
It, for me, it was a non-issue because I was going to play enough to unlock all the shit anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they can't make that assumption. Like not everyone is a sicko.
Yeah.
Through this.
Mm-hmm.
Theme wise these are fallen angels,
the banished star. Yeah,
the banished star. They have a mechanic called Valor, which is a little complicated.
Yeah.
Valor is a buff that can go on every unit and increases your attack power and gives armor at the end of the round for the front unit.
Yes.
So basically you set up a formation, you know, everybody gets Valor. The first one's going to be tankier and hit harder, and everyone's going to hit harder.
Yes. And it kind of feels a little bit like those are going to undercut each other, because if you're shifting things around, you have to be very intentional about who is going to end up at the front. Like one of your junk cards when you play the Vanish, not junk, but just kind of basic cards.
Starter
is
cards,
just
is to
take a unit and advance them to the front and give them some valor. But like the way that you can fuck with that is shifting somebody to the front also necessarily shifts that other unit back one, and that mm-hmm. triggers their shift keyword. And they have different effects, oftentimes stacking Valor on top. A couple of rounds into a wave, on playing the Banished or anything with Valor, you're going to end up with things that are just going to end up armored at the front, no matter what.
You can also shift multiple times.
Yeah.
You know, it wants you to be intentional about movement, which is a play space that the first game didn't play with very much. Like,
yeah,
you wanted to have tanks in the front, but your positioning didn't matter.
Right.
In the first one, other than just kind of general video game tanks up in front, DPS in back.
Yeah. You also get like spell cards that will not just move you forward and backward, but like you can raise or lower and get buffs, or like you raise and then like change the enemy position as well. Like, cause you scared him back.
All of these things work on everyone, actually. Like, you can use that shift to the front and give a buff to an enemy if you want that enemy to die. The buff won't matter. I just need them to be in front. That's another little bit of Monster Train secret sauce. Like, you have things that are beneficial, but you can use them on your own, on the enemy, if it would help you.
Yeah.
You know, and often, or things are detrimental that help you. For example, you know, if you have a character who has incant, which means every time you cast a spell, something happens, and you have a spell that gives a unit spell weakness, you think you're going to give that to the enemy, but the enemy doesn't cast spells. If you just have that in the end of your hand, cast it on your own guy and get that incant trigger.
Yeah.
Spell weakness doesn't matter to your characters. The enemy doesn't cast spells.
Yeah.
You know, and it's counterintuitive, but then once you you conceive of the idea to try, you get that feeling of delight that it works.
So when I say that like the Banished is a wild one for them to open for you at the start, I am thinking from the perspective of somebody who is coming in from not playing Monster Train, or like me, hasn't played Monster Train in a while. Like, the ability to move things around at will, and especially to like move stuff in between floors, like that is super cool in relation to knowing that Monster Train 1 doesn't move you around. If you don't have that, it is hard, I think, to see the appeal.
The benefit of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's the first Monster Train, you did move characters up and down on floors. Like, the Banished are interesting because they are kind of a shade of the first clan in Monster Train. The first clan in Monster Train 1 had Rage, which is like an attack buff, Armor, which is a defense, and could ascend and descend units. So you could overstack a floor. This has movement, armor, and attack as well. It's just a different iteration. It's 100% harder to onboard, though, because you're learning at the same time you're learning rooms and equipment, deployment. Like, you're getting a lot of stuff all at once. This can be an overwhelming game when you start it.
Yeah. I mean, and just Valor working in this kind of conditional way to get armor, trying to understand what armor is on top of all of that. But like, once you understand it, it's just like, oh yeah, armor's fucking great. And Valor never counts down. And you just always have a source of armor at the end of a turn if you want to.
For your front unit, for your tank.
Yes.
Like, it makes sense that these guys are, out of these five, this would be the one you would start with.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think any of these other clans are easier to use, but it is.
No.
Like I said, it's about on par, I'd say, with the Penumbra. And from their first clan in terms of complication.
Yeah.
They also have an emphasis on melee weakness. So that makes the enemy take double damage. Damage shields, so they don't get hit. And then those Hymnist units we talked about, which are little one-space units that buff the entire line.
Yeah. Every one of the clans has a unit that is kind of like this. Like little, basically monsters that you play that are like resources.
Support.
Yes. Yeah. And these are
extra trained. All Hymnists.
Yeah. These are really powerful. Like, you just put these at the back of your rank. But like the upbeat Warbler gives everybody quick, which is ridiculous. Gives just you attack
lets
first.
You go first.
Yeah.
Like, usually the enemy attacks you first and then you counterattack. But if you have quick, you attack first.
And then Punk Shredder is amazing because that is one of the ways that you get trample that is not inherently on, a card on a monster card that you get.
Yeah, really, really good. Again, though, you can't deploy them, you know, so you have to leave space for them when you're deploying, which is an interesting, trick. Or you need to find a way to deploy them on another floor and then raise or lower them to get them on the same floor.
Yeah.
there are two kind of emphases that the two champions have in this. Fel is kind of the Valor and Shift champion. They do a couple interesting things. They have a thing where every time they shift, they get Valor permanently, which is really powerful if you can shift them a lot. I mean, you get a really powerful Fel by the end of the game.
There's a there's a monster unit you can get that's called the Battle Dancer. From this as well. If you place the two of them on the same floor and you just kind of like keep toggling them back and forth, they are always gaining.
Yeah, they both
they're
power
always
up.
Gaining Valor. You can do just a shitload of damage.
It's really good. You can either spec him for damage or he can be a tank where you put him at the front, and when he gets hit as a revenge trigger, when he gets hit, he gains Valor.
Yeah.
So you want him, that's one of those situations where you might want to play on the first floor because you want him to get hit a lot.
Yes.
He's going to get that armor back. As long as he survives, he's okay. Mm-hmm. And then there's usually the champions have kind of a bummer path.
Yeah.
His bummer path is the one that allows him to shift to the front and gain a little bit of Valor. Mm-hmm. If you take that all the way to level 3, it gives everybody in the line armor equal to your Valor, which is really good. But you need to get it all the way to level 3.
Yeah, and that's not going to benefit you until ring 7, right?
Yeah, kind of a bummer. Yeah. And then Talos, another character from the first game, is kind of based around flight, which is a new keyword that allows you to move, and then buffing. She's kind of like a cleric for your team. So she can always fly. You know, if you deploy her on a different floor and just move her to the floor you want, you know, you can overstack the floor. But she has things where she can give everyone Valor at the end of turn. She can shift and cause melee weakness, so she can debuff the enemy. Or she can, what's the third one? Oh, give upgrades.
So on Celebrate, like at the end of a battle, if she is still alive, all of the units that are on her floor gain +2 attack and
not
plus
just her
two.
Floor, all units.
Oh, all like units.
Everyone who's alive. It's usually the people who are on her floor because she's usually on the top fighting the boss. Mm-hmm. And everyone up until that point died. But all units that fit in the battle get a big buff.
And permanently, like just for the entire run.
Yeah.
So you end up getting like a handful of like super units that you can deploy.
Both champions teaching you something about how to play.
Yes.
You know? The Pyreborn are really interesting. These are dragons and devils from hell. And they're money focused. They have several new mechanics that are, again, add new dimensions to the game, not just things you hadn't fucked with.
Right.
They remind me a little bit of the Wyrmkin in that they add a new resource, which is called the Dragon's Hoard.
Yeah.
There are eggs you can get. You have different things that can give you eggs. At the end of battle, you get to choose to save your eggs or spend your eggs. And
The longer
you save up, the better it is.
Yeah. And the longer you sit on the eggs, the more valuable they're going to get. You can unlock, you know, kind of like additional kind of tiers of waiting on these to just kind of like give yourself a huge advantage at the end of the run if you can be patient.
This comes with, you always get money when you trade in your eggs. And then if you get 4 eggs, they have their own set of minor artifacts. These are artifacts that specifically synergize with them and are not super powerful, but some of which are pretty good. You get a choice of those, and then eventually you start getting real artifacts. And then if you can raise your egg cap, you can eventually start getting the end boss upgrades, like increasing your ember or your draw or your space. For this, you have to build them up though, and usually it's an opportunity cost to get an egg. You either spend ember or you have to use a certain creature or do a certain thing to get the egg.
Like, and they're really big on kind of like conditional spells. It's like, okay, you do a little bit of damage, but if you kill, you'll get an egg. Like on the back of this. So it's like a little bit like Pokemon kind of stuff. Like, okay, I need to weaken this thing. So when I use the ability, I turn them into an egg for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Really weak defensively.
Yes.
This is one of the clans that I think needs another clan the most. There's one creature who scales with the egg. There's a dragon that gets a buff when he gets summoned. Based on how many eggs you have. And that's another way you can play them. You can get up to 8 eggs and just hang out and have like a super tank through that. But other than that, they kind of lack tanks.
Yeah.
The other mechanic they start with
sacrificial
is
stuff.
They want you to sacrifice stuff. Yeah. There's another clan later, the Lazarus League, that also has sacrifice as a big theme. Yeah. The other mechanic they start with is Pyrogel.
Yes.
This is a debuff. You spit on the enemy, and the next time they take damage, they take that much more damage.
Right.
So if the enemy has 3 Pyrogel and they take 10 damage, they take 13 damage instead.
And does that tick down? I forget if it ticks down.
I can't remember either. Typically, it hasn't come up because I've usually used it on the same floor I get it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I kind of don't think so, but I don't remember.
Yeah. So the strategy that implies is if you want to build around it, build it so that you are just stacking as much Pyrogel on the enemies on the lower floors as you can, so that even your weakest enemies can finish off whatever they need to by the time they get to the third floor, right?
And spells like one of their spells, it one cost or a zero cost one damage spell, which ordinarily wouldn't do anything, but if you have Pyrogel,
yeah,
you can do a lot more than one damage.
Yes. With
it. So spells become very powerful if you can stack this up.
Yeah. And that's a thing with the whelps specifically too, like yes. The bloated whelps, the ones that you can, that are basically spells in unit form.
The whelps are crazy to me. I never got them to work, you know, like I'd summon them sometimes. There's one that like sneezes on the enemy and gives them some Pyrogel, the snotty whelp. There's one that gives enchant your whole team with avarice and stuff, which we'll talk about in a second. But the whelps kind of suck.
Yeah.
They're kind of an analog to the imps in the first game. And one of the champions has a path that's all around the whelps. Yeah. But the whelps aren't very good.
No.
I found.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a weird misstep there. Avarice just gives you money when you attack. You have Avarice 10. Every time you attack, you get 10 gold.
Yes.
For this.
Which compounds over the course of a battle. And that gives you, you know, that much more. When you're at shops, if you end up like exhausting the stock that is there, you can just pay money to re-roll and get more options too. It doesn't just re-roll the ones that are still available. So like you can really get deep on the upgrades and stuff that you're going to get. Or especially like trinkets. God, a Pyreborn run just full of trinkets.
Yes. You can end up with so many artifacts.
Yeah.
Like if you have a good egg synergy, you can end up with a Pyreborn artifact and a actual artifact at the end of every battle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, starting from battle 3. Really powerful.
Yeah.
The two champions are Lord Phoenix and Lady Gilda. These are like a newspaper comic, husband and wife.
Yep.
Their actual little skits are fucking intolerable.
Just like the Lord Phoenix saying, like, I did not anticipate that you would deplete our Pyrogel reserve so much. I'm going to have to charge you extra. Cool, yeah. Cool, man.
You spent all of our Pyrogel on shoes. You know, Lord Phoenix, let's have sex. No, Gilda.
Plausible flush. Pyreborn.
Yeah. The sucks. Lord Phoenix has basically he can either increase the Pyrogel on a floor, he can do an ability that spits Pyrogel on everything, or he can what is the third one?
It's the conjure where you gain eggs.
Yeah, you gain eggs.
Yeah.
For it. And then Lady Gilda is more about eggs and money. She'll either summon 2 eggs behind her. That are units that can't attack, but if you have them at the end, you get the eggs. She can just be a big trampler, or she can give everyone avarice.
Yeah.
Or give your whelp units, like make whelp units cheaper to play on the floor, but she takes up 3 spaces.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Just hard to use.
Yeah. I don't care for either of these champions. Pyreborn is such a support clan for me.
Yeah. For sure. Like I've made all the champions work really well. From playing it a bunch, but I was in a similar spot when I started, largely because I tend to play games defensively.
Yeah.
And these guys not having a strong defense game made them harder to figure out initially.
Yeah.
The third clan is the Luna Coven. These are witches from another realm that was destroyed by the Titans. They're kind of like moon elves.
Yeah.
They add another UI thing similar to the Dragon's Horde. They add a moon phase.
Yes.
So, when you have any Luna Coven things, every turn, the moon will shift between full and
full and new.
Full and new moon. And then they have things that synergize based on that.
Yes. So there's some units that are most effective during one phase, other units that are most effective during the other, and you get spells and unit abilities that will let you manipulate the shifting. Yes. And generally, like, one of the modifiers, one of the keywords that different units can have is, like, on shift, not shift, capital S shift, but when the moon phase changes, they activate some kind of buff. Yep. Yeah.
So you can kind of build them as a new moon or a full moon mm-hmm. build. Like, they have different units for that. Or you can take advantage of units that let you switch. And what happens when you switch? The champions kind of do that. Mm-hmm. They have a thing called Conduit, which is a buff your creatures get, which increases the magic power on the floor.
Yes.
And this synergizes really well with their base spell, which is a zero cost, one damage, or one healing, depending on who you use it on.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get a bunch of conduit, this becomes a bigger damage, bigger healing.
Yes. Free damage, but you have, like, only on a particular floor is what it is. And of course, there's a floor card or a room card that you can get for these for these guys that will double that up as well. Yep.
Or give everyone conduit when you start, things like that.
Yeah. Also, like, their champion, one of the builds you can get is just like, yeah, you always have, like, conduit. And if you give them a particular piece of equipment, that conduit is just constantly climbing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They have attuned abilities. Attuned is a return from the first game, which means it gets more power if it's buffed. So, like, a mm-hmm. spell does 10, but it's attuned. If you add 10 to it, it actually adds 20. So yes. anything you add to it is more powerful. Mage Blade, which is just a buff to attack based on how much magic power is on the floor
mm-hmm.
There. And then there are silent units and fey units, which are the new moon or full moon and new moon units respectively. And those have individual synergies, and the two champions more or less correspond to that.
Yeah.
This is probably, out of all the clans in this is probably my least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
They're cool. I've had really great runs with them and everything. They have a really bad early game. Yes. I find, like, they're really tough in the early game.
Mm-hmm.
They need a lot of help. Eventually you can make this absolutely broken and powerful. Like, you can all.
Oh,
of them,
yeah. But, this particular clan was some of the, highest just individual, like, damage per round that I ever made that I managed to get in my time with this. Like, if you want to just do raw damage, you have to kind of trade that off for just this built-in fickleness.
Yes.
About them. And also, like, the starter deck on these guys, that little zero cost, you know, one damage thing, you're going to be drawing a lot of those.
Yes. And you need conduit for them to be useful at all.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so you have to build up some conduit. Yeah. The two champions synergize with this. Eka, who gets more conduit as you go. I don't play these guys as often as I do other people, so I'm trying to remember all of her abilities.
Yeah. Yeah. So her Spellweaver class just starts with a bunch of conduit mm-hmm. right away. And then anytime you cast a spell, including those, including the like little free ones, you stack conduit on top of that. So over the course of an individual, kind of battle, if you just like place her at the top, by the time anybody gets to her, if you're just casting free spells up there, you're good. Yeah.
Yeah. She also has one that does with, shifting the moon. I want to say every time the moon shifts, she gets a buff
mm-hmm.
through that. So that's something that happens every turn.
Yeah.
The one I've spent more time with is the secondary champion, Ardun,
mm-hmm.
Who is more of a heavy hitter. He's got healings into the Mage Blade bit. So he gets more powerful as you get conduit. He also has an ability that will give him like plus 50 and change it to new moon
mm-hmm.
For that. Like, you can use that every other turn. That's really powerful with new moon units, with silent units.
Yeah.
So you can make him really work with that.
Mm-hmm. For as much as like this whole thing reads as, oh, this is the squishy caster, the clan, that's only kind of the case. There are like whole lines of units. And then this particular hero that are really effective in like battle. That like are hardy and survivable, but Mage Blade lets them just do ridiculous stuff again if you can build to it.
Yep. They have good tanks that have low damage. Early on, you're encouraged to get your damage from spells.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite clan when I first started, this is the next one, the Under Legion, which are mushroom friends. What does this have to do with monsters or heaven or hell? It doesn't fucking matter.
Doesn't matter.
Stop seeing these as anything. There is no story.
Like one of the cutscenes, they're like, oh, it would be impossible without the Under Legion's numbers. Right.
Yeah.
They just provide the expendable shock troops with their ubiquitous unit, the fungi.
Yeah. Which is a stack of mushrooms on top of each other, sneaking into a movie.
That gets bigger.
Yes. It's real cute. This is a pretty complicated mechanic, I find. Mm-hmm. It's something called spawn, which will give you a fungi unit at the top. Mm-hmm. And every time you spawn, you don't get more units. That unit gets bigger.
Yes. That unit doesn't count against your floor deployment limit, right?
It does, but it doesn't. It can overflow it. So you can have all your spaces filled and then do a fungi, and it will take one more space, but it's a bonus space.
Yeah.
It's easy to overflow with them. Mm-hmm. So these stack up. You get stacks of this thing called troop on the spawn until it becomes a huge stack of little fun mushroom men. Mm-hmm. This is really interesting. You can make a one really big unit, but without help, that unit can't get trample, it can't get multi-strike, it can't get sweep. So it works really well as a tank and works really well as a big, a lot of damage to the first unit, mm-hmm. but it needs help.
Yes.
Through this.
If these guys are like the privates, then you end up getting a bunch of like commanders that will modify these guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the most internally synergistic clan.
Yes.
There's three units and you put them together and you win with this. There's a little guy that gives them trample. There's a guy that gives you two spawn every turn. And there's one that every time something gets added to the floor, everyone gets regen.
Yeah.
And that will just keep everyone alive and give you this ever-growing super trampler at the front. If you can get all three of those units on the thing, you'll win. And if you have Bullet, if you can get him on the floor as well, like, good night.
Yeah.
Because he also does a lot of spawning.
Yeah. Even their seemingly weak ones, like the green recruit as well.
Yeah.
Just synergizes with like any number of these. Seems to not be that big of a deal on its own. Very low cost. It's a no cost unit. And when it dies, it spawns four. So you can just keep on chugging through these things or put revitalize on them.
Yes.
Reanimate and then just like constantly stack on your troops.
They work as great as like a chump blocker that gives you more value when they get hit.
Yeah. Playing this, it's been too long for me to say if they are exactly analogous. But like this reminds me of the Candle Boys from the first, at least in terms of breakability. Once I unlocked the Candle Boys, it was easy to win runs in Monster Train 1. It just made sense to me because it is broken and for newbies.
And more, it's good for newbies, but it's like once you get it, right? Yeah. Like I feel like spawn and troops are kind of complicated mechanics to understand, but once you understand them, they're very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of seeing that everything works for you and the enemy. So like one of the things, there's a room you can get with these guys where when anything dies on the floor, you spawn one. And at first I thought that was just my units, but it's enemy units as well.
Yeah.
So you like stack that up and again, you just get a super mushroom at the front. It's really charming. Mm-hmm. They have harvest and rally. Rally is when something joins, that includes stacks of troop. And then harvest is when anything dies.
Yeah.
You're really powerful. And then they kind of do the, like the bio stuff.
Yes. Really powerful stuff that sucks when it is done to you.
Yes.
They get sap and they get decay.
Sap is a debuff to your attack. Mm-hmm. It slowly goes away, but it's really powerful. The enemy does it to you as well. Mm-hmm. Decay is damage over time.
Yeah.
That you take. And then they can also do regen. And their champions lean into both these things really well. Again, that internal synergy. Bullet the Guillotine, who looks like the big mushroom guys from Darkroot Garden.
I love it.
Yep, yeah. He's great. Big boy. The thing that I was enamored with when I first started was the one that gives him a permanent up every time something, you know, rallies, every time something joins his floor.
That's so,
and just getting like a 400 power bullet.
It's so fucking dumb. He just slaughters everything if you stack troops on him.
Yeah, yeah. Becomes just like a big fucking beast. He also has things where he can spawn. Like every time he harvests, he will spawn, things like that. Mm-hmm. He's the mushroom man.
Yes. I didn't get to spend an awful lot of time with Madame Lion's Mane.
She's real good. She's mm-hmm. the decay champion. Mm-hmm. She has two abilities I really like. She can also do a spawn one where every time she does an incant, so every time you cast a spell, she'll spawn. Mm-hmm. But she has two things I really like. One, before anything happens in the round, she gives everyone one stack of decay, and whatever decay is added, it adds +3. Mm-hmm. And this gets better as you go. So like she'll just decay everyone and make decay really powerful on that floor.
Yeah.
Or she gets an ability that starts off just decaying an enemy, decaying and sapping, and then eventually decay saps and mutes them, and she can use it every turn. So she can kind of neutralize an enemy.
Yeah.
Each turn. Mm-hmm. She's great.
Yeah. Just generally, like, this is also the debuff. The debuff one as well, because of a keyword called propagate, which is just when a debuff shows up, it is just more powerful. They make debuffs more potent. So like I'd never rolled with these guys in a support role, but I can absolutely see it making other stuff just stomp.
Yeah, you have a thing that will, if it's on your character, will increase their buff. If it's on the enemy character, will increase their debuff.
Yeah,
by a stack. There's a room that does that. That's really powerful.
Yeah.
You know, everyone propagates at the end of the turn. So you get more buffs. The enemy gets more debuffs.
Yeah.
Very powerful and kind of the key to, for me, in moving up the covenants initially, through these guys. Eventually they have a little bit of a tough time in the late game. Again, getting to the back line and stuff. Like they can punch through the first row, but they don't have a lot of options to get through the back line. I think the hardest one to get a grok on, they're very powerful, but the hardest one to get a handle on is the Lazarus League.
Yes.
The last one we unlock.
Yeah. It is a whole army of Frankensteins. This is the mad science one. Yeah.
Mad science thing. The Frankensteins a-poppin', abominations. the idea they do are equipment focused, and they have two kind of main mechanics, which are reanimate and unstable. Mm-hmm. Unstable is fucking confusing.
Oh my, this is the thing that made this so hard to do. Primarily because your champion, one of the paths that you're likely to get to choose for that, just he starts with unstable and it gets more unstable every turn.
Yeah, and he gets reanimate, so he can come back.
Yeah,
but you need to stack reanimate on him. That path can be crazy good if you give him a lot of reanimate, but you need support.
Yes,
the easiest path for him is the one that gives unstable to the enemy on a recant, because unstable means if your health is below your unstable level at any point, you blow up and you do damage equal to your unstable level to everyone.
Yes.
Not your character, to all the enemies.
Yeah.
So this causes like chain reactions and stuff. Like unstable is wildly powerful. It's really, really good if you concentrate on it.
Yes. And also if you know how to use it.
Yeah. the enemy gets a special little symbol. It'll say they'll blow up instead of die at the end of a round for their preview. Many, many runs saved by unstable.
Yes.
Reanimate is more complicated. Reanimate, you put it on a character, they have a stack of it. If they die with reanimate, they come back with one health and they lose a stack of reanimate. Yeah. This is really cool if you can stack it up in big amounts.
Yes.
Because what that means, sounds like nothing because it's one health, but you think one health can take a hit of any size.
Right.
You know, you can take 500 damage and one health and you just come back with one health.
Yeah.
You know, it basically kind of gives you a free hit of any size. You get
a good preview. Like, so this is the one that I unlocked the last. Makes sense because it's the most technical. oh my gosh. You get a good demonstration of this well before you get these guys there's a boss.
Yeah, the boss.
The boss called the Undying, which is a cool visual design as well. He has just reanimate on him all the time, and it'll grow.
He's also a don't play on the top floor guy because he gains it as he goes up.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, okay, so I just have to keep on. Well, no, that is more attacks that are taken to keep him down.
Yes.
It's a little bit like damage resistance or Titanite on the back end as opposed to the front.
If you hit hard a few times, you will struggle with reanimate. You have to hit soft many times with it. Very, very powerful, but you kind of have to go in on it.
Mm-hmm.
They have something called Mix. If I had to choose my least favorite thing about the game, it's the interface for Mix.
Yeah.
It's slow. Mm-hmm. Mix is, you get a choice between two effects, either, you know, two positive effects or two negative effects that are minor that cost zero. You mix, you get a spell, and you can stack mixes. So every time you do mix before you cast the spell, you'll get, it'll make the mix better.
Yes.
Every time you get a little menu where you choose between two cards, though, and it seems slow to me.
Yeah.
I find it a little bit tedious.
Mm-hmm. It was also just kind of like de rigueur. Like, you're making some choices. Like, there's blasting infusion, which is unstable, enfeebling, which is sap, Goliath, which is rage, and madman, which is regeneration. Like, you're just kind of picking, okay, am I going to eventually use this on an enemy, or does my build require me to use this to shore up one of the incredibly specific weaknesses that is kind of baked into every single one of the units from here.
And you don't get to choose if you're getting positive or negative,
right,
for this. So it can be a little bit of a crapshoot. I understand the flavor of it.
Yeah.
You know, it just, you know, I'll take it when it's available, but I tend to favor unstable as a build for this.
Yeah.
They also do spikes and lifesteal, and then sacrificing and equipment synergies.
Yes.
They have a whole line of units called graft units, which are a weak unit that comes with a really powerful piece of equipment you can't otherwise get.
Mm-hmm.
So you send that unit out to sacrifice them, and then you get the equipment.
Yes.
And these are crazy. These are really, really good pieces of equipment. You can get multi-strike, which is hard to get without downsides from other equipment. Yes. You can get, you know, no condition multi-strike. A really good gain rage on strike and revenge. So your character's just always getting more powerful. Stuff like that.
Yeah. They have a couple of throwaways, because you also get the assistance as well.
Yes. the assistants are, there's kind of two kinds of them. Or three kinds of them, and they synergize most with the secondary champion, Baron Grail, who looks like he should have more health than he does.
Yeah.
He's a big hulking monster who is, you know, kind of a wuss.
Yeah.
But he's the equipment and sacrifice champion. So he can eat assistants to gain their stats, and then he can have things happen when you equip him. You either equip him and everyone on the floor gets a buff, or the piece of equipment gets a permanent buff.
Yes.
And this will work for grafted units. Mm-hmm. If you, you know, take the double strike from the grafted unit, put it on him, the next time that grafted unit comes in, it's still using the same piece of equipment in the game's logic. So that'll be a better piece of equipment.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not unlock this guy.
He's hard to use. Yeah. Like I find.
But so is Horechi. So is the mad scientist with the grafted arm on his back.
Yeah. Except for the unstable one. I feel like the unstable one is pretty easy to use. Just cast spells. The other two is he gets to mix every turn, which is a fine bonus, but not that powerful. And then the other one is the unstable one, which is really hard to use. You have to have a lot of reanimate for that. And the creatures in this all have synergies with all this shit.
Yes. You know,
so like this creature gets a permanent buff every time it's equipped. This creature, when it dies, it reanimates with armor. And when it dies, it spreads all of its armor to the units behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you can give that a big stack of reanimate, it can become really good.
Yes.
You know, as a tank. They're complicated, though. This one took me the longest to get used to.
Yeah. Just a real big whiff of, like, if I just understood this better, this might be one of the most broken things in the game, but I just don't. Yeah.
I think it's largely considered to be the most broken clan, but they're definitely the highest, like, skill floor, I feel like.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took me forever to get them. Like, when I first got them, I was like, these guys are a bummer. I don't like this clan at all. And like, now they're also a really powerful support clan, weirdly enough. Because graft units are good for everybody. Lifesteal is good for everyone. Like, a lot of the stuff that they do, you want.
Yes. Yeah. So like, I at least beat Seraph, you know, like a Seraph with every clan. This is, I think, the one where it was like, I could only get to Seraph. I couldn't beat him with it. So yeah, just to give you a sense of like how beyond me it was at the level I'm playing at.
It was for me for a long time too. No judgment, because it's tricky.
Yeah.
And then there's a fun surprise. So the whole time I was playing this, I was thinking, God, I hope that I want to see how this interacts with this.
Yeah.
These new clans are kind of echoes of other clans. Like the Under Legion is kind of like the, you know, it has a little bit of the Wormkin, because it's about, you know, they also have some consume synergies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like the Frostfish, because it has, you know, a damage over time thing.
Yeah.
And then at Six Pyre Hearts, all the old friends come back.
Yeah. You get Game Master Anthony'd. Your friends from every video game. Video game was Monster Train 1, just comes out of a portal and they're like, it's time to work together, baby. You double the number of clans. You have to unlock them. Like, you just have the Hellhorned at the start. But like, I don't know, you just instantly doubling and like trying to take these units from the context where they never had to deal with any of this new shit and adapt them in to, you know, have uses and thrive is ridiculous. The amount of scope that this adds,
they're rebalanced to work with the new things, and they synergize in surprising ways with the new clans. You know, if you have like the Shardtail Queen, which is the alternate champion of the Hellhorned, she has one of her paths is to get stronger on Rally. Well, you play her with the Under Legion and you do a Mushroom Bolt, and she gains power faster than like Bullet does.
Yeah.
From that. Like, there's a lot of things you can do. You know, the Melting Remnant have a unit that gets more powerful if they harvest. You do them with the mushroom guys, and every time the stack of mushroom guys gets hit, it maybe counts as losing 3 or 4 units.
Yeah.
So he gains 20 stats every time you get hit.
Yeah.
You know, it's really neat. You can double up strengths. Like if you play the Frost Legion with the Luna, come to do the 2 spell units, those synergize really well.
It's so ridiculous.
It's real cool. Like you can either double up, you can switch them. And it just means, again, there's 180 clan combinations that you can do now. And that's a lot. It's a lot of play space.
Yes. And like there are like whole, I don't know, just like RPG needs that are not addressed by the first five, by the first five clans. Like the Moon Coven has a little bit of healing stuff in it. Not a lot though.
Yeah.
You pull the Awoken in and suddenly like, oh, I have like a straight up like support cleric.
Yes.
Kind of deal that brings Rooted back. How amazing is Rooted?
Rooted is really good, and it doesn't show up in the main game.
Yeah.
You know, as a thing. It eventually does in Mix. A really clever thing that happens is the old mechanics get added to Mix once you unlock these guys.
Yeah.
So you just have those first Mix options, but then once you unlock the Awoken, Rooted will become an option for a debuff, and Frostbite will become an option for a debuff.
Yeah.
Once you unlock them, they didn't want to spoil it. just really, really fucking generous. Like, this is the type of game where the interest comes not on the back end of what you're against. It's what you're doing. Your verbs, kind of like Isaac. And doubling that is just very generous.
Yeah. And they're going to add another clan, and I don't put it above them to sneak the Wormkin back as well.
Yeah, I really hope the Wormkin come back, because those guys are great. They don't have skits.
Yay!
Yeah, they don't hang out and talk. They're here for business.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the tree doesn't talk to the wax gangster priest. You know, it's good. I don't want them to talk.
No, they got nothing to do with each other. Yeah.
You know, we kind of, in talking about a lot of the mechanical play space, we've kind of encountered or encapsulated a lot of stuff that can happen with the bosses.
Yes.
In this, and enemies. The enemies will usually have a concept, you know, where it's like, okay, these guys, this boss gets reanimated as it goes up. This boss gains armor every turn. This boss gains damage shield every time it goes up. You know, things like that. You can always preview these and plan for them.
Yes.
As a thing. The ring bosses, the three main bosses, have different unique abilities.
Yes.
Through this. And there's only the three now.
Right. And they're adding alternates with the new stuff, yes. Right? Yeah. Yep. Big deal. But also like, okay, there are only three now, but each of them has at least three variants, right?
Yes.
Not Archaon, I think. Archaon is pretty consistent. Archaon's got three. Does he?
Okay. Yeah. Archaon's got, so Archaon's the first one you do every time. And his, he has a variant where he, just does a lot of damage mm-hmm. to things. And when you kill one of his units, he gets stronger.
Okay.
He has a variant where he pushes your unit to the back. So he shifts you. Mm-hmm. Through that to disrupt your tank strategies. And then he has a path where if he's on a floor with nobody on there, he does damage to your pyre heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Through that. All requiring different kinds of play styles.
Yeah.
Through that. But he's also the first major boss. He's pretty easy.
Yeah. He's not hugely taxing. Also, like, he has one of the most limited quote pools. He's constantly telling people to get out of his face.
Yeah. he's like a bird. He's like an angry bird. Mm-hmm. Kale, who is the Rusty, little redheaded cherub mm-hmm. On a bunch of clouds. This guy is the first like hard boss, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah. This shit gets out of hand. He is specifically built for his forces to snowball on you more than other stuff.
You got to do the bottom floor for Kale. He's an inversion of the Penumbra.
Yeah.
As opposed to you having morsel units that you can eat, he has, which also count for harvest if you do Penumbra with a harvest clan, mm-hmm. just into those synergies. But he does these little cherubs that have 60 HP, at least on the difficulty I'm on. And mm-hmm. if they survive until the end, they buff everyone on their floor.
Yes.
And the buffs are really intense. Like basically, if you let somebody get to the top, you'll lose mm-hmm. of this if they get the cherub buff every time.
Yes. There's not really like it says something that the most advantageous one is the vampiric feeder.
Mm. The one that I find the easiest is the damage shield one.
Okay.
Because I think, I don't know if this is, I don't know what's on covenants, mm-hmm. but at least on the covenant I'm playing, the life drain one also gives a buff in attack and they end up hitting like way too hard
mm-hmm.
by the end.
Yeah.
Damage shield I can usually get through because I can either ping him with a spell or I can I have multi-strike.
Yes. Yeah.
But generally you have to play on the bottom floor for Kale.
Yes. The nourishing feed on that is fucking absurd too. Also, like, he doesn't start at the bottom floor and proceed upward. He is like Seraph and like Archaon. He is moving from floor to floor. He will deploy the feed onto whatever floor he happens to go to.
He's he goes to a floor with units on it.
Yes.
A random floor with units. Mm-hmm. And then finally you have the Seraphs at the end. And this is one of the this is something I kind of hope they balance, because one of these is clearly like much harder than the other ones.
Fucking Savage Seraph.
Yeah, Savagery is really tough.
Yeah.
This is what ends my streaks
mm-hmm.
When I'm doing streaks at Covenant 10.
Yeah.
This is the final boss. Savagery enchants your characters with melee weakness
mm-hmm.
Every turn. And it does, the enemies are just really hit really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes with sweep units, so your backline units are not safe.
No, not at all. And when Seraph is on a floor and applying these, he also is blasting through everybody too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really hard. Like Savagery, you need to have a very specific build to counter. The mm-hmm. other ones kind of allow you a little bit more flexibility.
Yes.
Here. So like Savagery, I would like to have balanced a little bit. Mm-hmm. Personally, that's the hardest one. The other two, the second hardest one, I think, is the Corruption one.
Yeah.
Corruption is a damage over time that does not disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually lower amounts, but it stacks, keeps stacking, and it never goes away.
Yes.
This is a real problem if you have a lot of squishy units and you don't have mm-hmm. a way to give them armor or heal them.
Yeah. Specifically too, like he'll apply sap on you guys. You have to be very cautious not to cast any spells. When he is on a floor, because otherwise you end up just completely nerfing your own units, and it'll take a long time for that to come down. It kind of never does.
Does he sap or is it? I think one of the enemies in one of his crew saps. I think corrupts.
It's an ability that he has on enchant.
Makes his units
yeah.
And then the easiest one by far is the one that gives you. It's basically a DPS check. Mm-hmm. It gives you cards that if you don't play them, if you play them, it gives all of your units sap. If you don't, it does damage to your pyre.
That's what I was talking about. I apologize. Oh, yeah. I was talking about the entropic one. You were talking about the dominant one. Yeah.
Yeah. No worries. I don't remember their names. It's all wireframe to me. I'm like, what they do. So no worries at all. The sap one, you either have a pyre that can tank all that shit, or you're scaling damage fast enough to eat the saps.
Yes.
By far the easiest one. The biggest problem is he also gets sweep units on the bottom floor, and that can fuck you up. Yeah. Little pro tip for people who are going up against that Seraph, find an Inferno room and put it on the first floor.
Oh, God.
And it takes care of a lot of his problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, like, all of these guys have a shitload of health. Like, any of the, ring bosses that you get, Archaean, Kale, are going to have, they're going to be checks to make sure that you have built your engine at least a little bit to damage them so it doesn't become full-on attrition. Seraph especially.
It graduates really nicely. Like, Archaean is not hard, but you do want to have a direction for Archaean. Like, you want to be at least going in a direction. Kale, you want to be a little bit further along. And then Seraph, you kind of have to have the apex of whatever you're going for.
Yes.
Through that. I mentioned this earlier, but again, if you're struggling with Monster Train, you can look at these. You can pull up the map.
Yep.
And see who you're going to fight.
Mm-hmm. And build to it.
Like, I usually don't check Archaean because, like, he doesn't hard counter stuff as much.
Yeah.
But I always check Kale because if Kale's going to give me the Spikes one or the Lifesteal one, I need to be able to go on the bottom floor. And I always check the Seraph because you need specific counters. They unlock a thing after you get all of the available Covenant Hearts or Pyre Hearts where you unlock the Titans. There's a trial you can do for each of the ring bosses that buffs them. You can turn it on or off. So you do Archaean or like tougher Archaean. Mm-hmm. It makes them more of what they are. And if you beat them, you go and you fight the Titans. And like the thing with the Titans is it's kind of a check, but it's all of the checks at once.
The Titans look absurd.
Really hard. Yeah. Like you're not, I don't think you're meant to streak the Titans. Like just keep playing the Titans. I think you're supposed to beat the Titans and then turn them off. Basically.
Yeah. You get the Titans so you can get their Pyre Hearts, right?
Yes. That's how I've been playing it. I find them very difficult. Like I've beaten them more than just the three times necessary, but they tend to end runs. They're really interesting though. So it's three bosses at once.
Yeah.
One boss is on every floor. It's a really tall guy. And he has tons of health. So you have to be able to punch through stuff and he corrupts everybody.
Yeah.
There is one guy who's on the bottom who is like a big melee tough guy, kind of like a centaur looking thing. And his gimmick is once he gets to the top floor, instead of going to the pyre, he goes back to the bottom and he gets a layer of multi-strike.
Yeah.
So like every time you allow him to cycle, he gets stronger.
Yeah.
And then there's a guy parked up by your pyre attacking it. He doesn't do very much damage, but he kind of acts as a time limit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just vibe like he's going to slowly drain you. And every time he attacks your pyre, you get a spell that you can cast to make the pyre attack back. So you can eventually kill that guy. Yeah. And they have an ability where you have to kill all of them. Killing just one of them, if you get one of them to 1 HP, he doesn't die. They all have to go to 1 HP, and then the next hit kills all of them.
Okay.
It's called, like, Fate Link or something like that.
That is absurd.
It's really hard. Like, doing it the first time was very difficult. I did it on Covenant 1 or Covenant 0 the first time. Like, I recommend if you're going to try for this, do it at low Covenants because it's already hard enough.
Yeah.
And you just really, everything kind of has to go right
to
make this work. Like if you have something really, really broken, you can do it really easily, but you need to be able to survive corruption on everything. You need to be able to punch through to hit the big tall guy in the back. Like it's tricky. You have to have enough pyre health. Like if you go into this with 30 pyre health, I don't think you can beat it.
Yeah.
Basically like it is a check that it's like a check plus.
Yeah.
You know?
The thing about it, like the victory conditions sound so specific that it sounds like certain builds or combinations are just not at all inclined to get you to where you need to be to be the key for this particular lock.
It feels like there are definitely builds you can end up at where you have no chance.
Yeah.
You know, you just, you don't have an answer for one of the many things it's throwing out at you. That's it for you. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was a wall for a long time. I didn't start doing kind of streaking on Covenant 10 until I stopped fighting these guys.
Right.
You know, because I was trying to, and I could get maybe like two in a row. And then mm-hmm. I would get Savagery, which would fuck up my Pyre Heart enough to where I'd get to these guys and just not have a chance.
Yeah.
I consider them a super boss, not something that you are supposed to just fight over and over.
Right.
In terms of fun. And in terms of just game design, it's neat to see, you know, to fight the three bosses at once. Mm-hmm. It's cool how they do it. It's neat. It's just not something I want to fight over and over.
Right.
So, and the reward for those is the first three times you get them, you get those really powerful Pyre Hearts.
Yes.
And then you just keep playing for eternity with new combos and they keep updating it. And this is your game now.
Yeah. This is this is video games forever now.
Yeah.
So are there content changes at higher Covenant levels or is it just everybody's juiced?
There are content changes, in terms of everyone's juiced in different ways. Mm-hmm. Costs go up. You get, early on, you get more cards from your, partner clans mm-hmm. and stuff, which is an advantage, you know, generally. And then eventually you start getting, what I can't remember they're called, like a debuff card, a curse.
Yeah, the blights.
You know, a thing you have to spend. Yeah, a blight that comes in your deck, things like that. It's mostly just makes it harder mm-hmm. Through that. But it is the point, and this isn't a gamer brag, I put in, you know, Malcolm Gladwell a number of hours to get here, but like Covenant Zero is too easy for me now. Like I don't have to think about it very much.
No, Covenant Zero got too easy for me too. Yeah. It's just like, okay, this is the Arby's sandwich. There is no resistance in this.
No resistance. It's something in a soft, soft, soft sandwich.
Yes. A spoonable sandwich.
But don't feel bad if you are still struggling with that because you had to learn it.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of this thing I said for the last couple episodes, and it's a dumb thing to say, but like, if you don't like what this game is doing, you're not going to like it. You know, I don't think this is going to convert anyone, but mm-hmm. it is doing something I find a little special within the roguelike space. And if it's your bullshit, it's going to be laser targeted at your heart.
Yeah. And I always bring this up as like, what is a genre that just doesn't work for you, but there's like a thing that is your weakness in it. Mm-hmm. This point is unchanged from when we talked about Monster Train 1. Like, yes, you do have to enjoy the things that you are doing in this. I'm not somebody who likes roguelikes and deck builders. I'm not a magic person. So like the specific combination of like the tactical battle in this, you know, the deployments, like they're like they combine everything in the right ratios to even make it get past my I don't like the shit you're doing in this.
Yeah.
You know, kind of kind of filter for any other game that might have these things present in different varieties or different ratios, right?
Yeah. And I think if you are at all somebody who like thinks about design and mechanics and like how they work and how they work together, there's just too much to feast on here. Yeah. Like there's too much to think about mm-hmm. with this. Being constantly presented with a series of questions of how would these things work together? And the answer being the dev thought of that and it's really neat.
Yeah.
Over and over and over and still be unlocking it hundreds of hours in, you know, mm-hmm. finding things that you didn't realize would work together is why I play video games.
Yeah.
You know,
you have to
have in your gamer heart the idea of having a game that you don't beat.
Like yeah.
You can decide when you're done with it, but you decide when you're done with it. It's just a thing mm-hmm. you sit down to do a run.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have, I can do a run. Not everybody mm-hmm. has a run in them. Like they don't play games with runs.
Yeah.
You know, the same way that I don't do like an MMO, I can't do a season.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do a Destiny season. Like that doesn't work for me, but something mm-hmm. like this does.
Yes.
You know, and fits into my life really well. It takes me about 45 minutes to do a run. Mm-hmm. It's the perfect amount of time to play Switch before bed.
Yeah.
Just very, very easy to fit into my life. Yeah. Fits in my life easier than almost any other game.
And it's just super rare to step into a constructed world made by people who just do not believe in limiting principles.
Yeah. It's the commonality of the roguelikes I love.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, Balatro had similar energy. Isaac is the OG for mm-hmm. this stuff. You know, just let you do stuff. You know, it is a toy at the end of the day. It is a game.
Yeah.
You know, like it is a tactical challenge, but let that stuff be further along. Let that be advanced higher up the ladder, you know? Mm-hmm. So great game. Again, my game of the year with the caveat that I haven't played, you know, any of the games everyone else is going to say is game of the year.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is my favorite thing I played this year. And mm-hmm. I'm still playing it, and I'm still going to keep playing it. Like it hasn't lost its appeal for me yet.
Yeah. Huge thanks to Joey for executive producing this.
Yeah, thank you, Joey. And yeah, hopefully this was entertaining, and it wasn't just us saying keywords for 2 hours.
I mean,
again, and everyone, forgive my sicko shit. Let me be a sicko for this. Let me have this.
This is one of those things. This ought to be a balm for the Gary doesn't like anything people.
This is the most enthusiastic I've ever sounded on this podcast. Like, it is. I don't like lots of things, but the things I like, I really fucking like.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called Monster Train 2, and eventually Monster Train 3.
Yep.
If you're listening to this and you are any kind of disadvantaged person and you have a project or product you'd like us to shout out, please send me an email at gary@duckfeed.tv. We'd be happy to do so. We don't have anything this week, but yeah, send me an email. Include pronouns, any information you think I would need, and we'd be happy to do so.
If you have thoughts on Monster Train 2 or any of November's other games, which include Unpacking and our premium episode, Hitman Blood Money, you can go to duckfeed.tv/contact by November the 15th and write in. The same thing applies for December's games, which is just Wasteland 3. The deadline for that is December the 15th. Just go there. Mm-hmm. If you have thoughts about multiple games, please separate them into multiple responses, and we prefer responses that are specific and concise.
Yeah, Wasteland 3 does not include the DLCs. And little, pro tip for everyone, the tone does lit up a little bit. It's super goofy early on. It does not necessarily put in a good impression, but it does lit up. So give it a little bit of time. But it's a good game. It's, if you like a Shadowrun tactical CRPG, it's that. Mm-hmm. If you like us and you want to support us, if you want to hear that episode on Hitman Blood Money or next month's bonus episode, which I think we decided is the PRGE.
Yes.
Or the Zelda Bonfireside Chat.
No, Zelda Bonfireside Chat is the is the rerun we're doing for the beginning of the year.
Yeah. Yes. Little spoiler there for January's games. But if you want to hear our live panel at PRGE, guest starring the Retronauts, really fun panel, you can become a patron. If you go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv, $5 a month gets you all of our bonus episodes, including entire bonus shows. Bonus shows that are good. That we really like on Film Mobile Joy Fun. We talk about horror media, the Feel Bad Rainbow. During that, you get a big backlog of Abject Sufferings. At $10 and up, you get Adaptation Decay and Quack Stack, both of which are really fun.
Yeah. Loaded with value.
Yeah, we think so. And we really appreciate it, and it lets us keep doing this. So if you like this and you don't want us to have to go get jobs at Target, that is what helps us.
Yes, it keeps us out of Target. Yes. If you can't support us, we understand. Shit's fucking wild right now. There are free ways to support us. You can leave a rating or review. You can tell your friends, help spread the word. Leave comments if you can. Whatever podcast directory feedback you can give, please leave us positive stuff. It helps spread the word.
Yeah. And perhaps most importantly, save the date. December 12th and 13th for Duckstream 2025, our annual charity live stream. This year, we're doing it for Point of Pride. It is 48 hours of streaming. It's really fun, and more details will come.
Yeah. And also, please join us in thanking our producer, Gwen.
Big thanks to Gwen.
Yeah.
Until next time, what should they watch out for?
Watch out for eating that dragon's cake. You don't want to eat the dragon's cake. No.
It was a real big titty curvy dragon in this. And like a sexy mushroom too. There's doing a lot of stuff in this.